Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. 2013 marks the 100th anniversary of Woodrow Wilson's inauguration as President of the United States. He initiated the progressive New Freedom reform programs, founded the League of Nations after World War I, but was never able to persuade his own country to join it. Wilson's remarkable life is the subject of a new biography by A. Scott Berg. In it, he paints a portrait of America's 28th president that few have ever seen, the aloof scholar who was also a hopeless romantic, the progressive thinker who institutionalized segregation in Washington, the forceful leader frequently sidelined by health issues. Scott Berg is the author of four best-selling biographies, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lindbergh. Like Woodrow Wilson, Scott is a graduate of Princeton University. He lives in Los Angeles, and he is our guest today on Radio Time. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Tracy. Good to be here.
So Woodrow Wilson's rise to power was both meteoric and non-traditional, you might say.
In both senses, you're exactly right. It was the fastest rise in American history. It's hard to imagine it will ever be duplicated. In October of 1910, Woodrow Wilson was the president of a small college in New Jersey, Princeton. In November of 1912, he was elected president of the United States. So that in and of itself is remarkable, but he is also the only one who got there through the path of academia. He spent his entire life, had never run for office until he was in his mid-50s, and he became a public intellectual. And he's really the only president who has come from those ranks. He wasn't a war hero. He was not somebody who rose through legislatures in various states. He's just somebody who sort of burst on the scene.
How did that happen? How did he go from academia to governor of New Jersey to president of the United States in a span of 2 years?
Well, there was one brief interim moment in which he did run for office. He ran for governor of New Jersey, which was, if you can imagine, the most corrupt state in the Union. I'm speaking now of 1910 now, and it had a very corrupt Democratic machine, and they, quite frankly, were looking for a puppet. So they thought, who is the cleanest guy in the state of New Jersey? What about that professor, the president of Princeton? Why don't we go after him? He'll be easy to manipulate. And indeed, they did go after him, and they got him. And he ran for office. He won in a landslide. And the very first thing he did as governor of New Jersey was kick out the very machine that put him in office. And now everybody in America is looking to New Jersey and saying, who is this man?
What made you decide to pursue his story?
Well, there are two answers to this. The most truthful is that when I was 15 years old, I read a book about Woodrow Wilson and really became fascinated by him. And I think it was perhaps the tragic idealism of his life, because at 15, I was deeply into tragic idealism. I thought both those things were good, tragedy and idealism. But as I've been reading about him ever since, and as I was putting this book together, two big themes really occurred to me. And it's why I wrote the book and why I like talking about Wilson and why I want people to know about him. The first is, I truly believe he was the most influential person in the 20th century. I think he had a greater effect on life as we live it today, even. So much of our lives go back to Woodrow Wilson. And the second thing, and this, at the end of the day, is the most important reason I wrote it, I do think it is the most dramatic personal story that ever unfolded in the White House. And what I wanted to do was write a page-turner about a president. And I wanted the reader to walk in his shoes and see what it was like to be him and then walk into this new 20th century world that he would help shape.
It could very well be the most dramatic story that many people have never heard. When you look at the contradictions of his life and you look at the various facets of his personality, I think most people tend to think of him as sort of dour, very solemn, very serious, almost boring. And he was really anything but. Talk about his personality and some of the contradictions that you saw in his character.
You've really hit the nail on the head. And I think the biggest contradiction relates to what you just said, which is he was probably the most fervently passionate man who's ever sat in the White House. I'm not forgetting Lincoln here, but Wilson had great emotional swings. There are several moments in the book of such deep pathos that he's in tears. And I would find myself as a writer welling up as I was writing some of his speeches. He was a very ardent lover. He had two wives, not at the same time, I quickly add. But his first beloved wife, who was really for most of her life a professor's wife, Wilson was madly in love with her. They were in the White House 1 year, and quite tragically and fairly suddenly, she died. And now the president of the United States is so depressed, he can barely get out of bed. And fortunately, he met an attractive young widow who lived in Washington. Within a year, he courted her with hundreds of steamy, passionate love letters. And within that year, they were married. So again, it's just this juxtaposition, as you said, the really dour Woodrow Wilson, the Presbyterian minister's son, which he was, but combined with this was somebody who loved to sing, he danced, he always started every cabinet meeting with a joke. I mean, this was a genuinely jovial fellow, on the other hand.
And there was so much going on in this nation and the world at the time that his first wife died. I mean, he's got so many issues on his plate at this time, and he's just trying to function through the depression and the grief of losing his wife. Talk about that, if you would, what he was dealing with as president.
Exactly. Literally the moment his wife is on her deathbed in the White House, I mean, with days to go and fading away, in that very moment, there was an assassination in Europe which led to World War I. And Wilson is doing everything he can as the leader of the United States, one of the great neutrals, thousands of miles away from this budding war. He was doing everything he could to see that those leaders would not turn that assassination into a war. It was, of course, a hopeless cause. That war now seems inevitable in retrospect. But Wilson didn't think so in 1914. And there is a moment where he's sitting with one hand holding his wife's dying hand and with the other writing a letter to the leaders of the world saying, don't go to war. Isn't there not some solution? Is there something the United States can do? How can we help out?
And that strategy worked for a while. In fact, it was, I don't know if it was instrumental, but certainly helpful in his reelection campaign that he kept us out of war.
That's exactly right. And in 1916, when he ran for his second term, he was, quote, the peace candidate, largely because he did keep us out of war. You know, this is somebody who grew up in the South. He remembered the Civil War. His first memories, in fact, were of Abraham Lincoln being elected and being told that there was going to be a war about to break out. He saw what war did to the South, how devastated it was. And Wilson was just so determined to see that this country did not have to enter another war. And so he did everything he could diplomatically to keep us out of that war. But indeed, by 1917, the German belligerence just did not stop. We uncovered this secret telegram, the Zimmermann Note, which talked about Mexico and Germany forming an alliance in which Mexico would attack the United States and retrieve their territory of California and Texas. Well, anyway, all these things led to the fact that Wilson felt we finally had to go to war.
I want to pause there and rewind just a little bit and talk about his upbringing. You mentioned him growing up during the Civil War, remembering Lincoln's election. And in thinking about his contradictions, here you have a boy whose father is a Presbyterian minister. They're a strong Christian family in the midst of this war. And yet, he ended up being a supporter of segregation, having lived through the Civil War. Can you talk about that seeming contrast, how he was able to square his progressive ideas, his Christian faith, with segregation?
Yes. It's a very tricky subject a century later, of course, where even though I think there's so much racism left in this country, 100 years ago, racism was barely called that, simply because that was a way of life, certainly in the South. Woodrow Wilson's father, who was this minister, gave sermons on how the Bible basically supported slavery. It sanctioned it. And he would quote scripture to prove this. So this is what Woodrow Wilson grew up with. This is what most Southerners grew up with. And racism, it was beyond just being slaveholders, which the Wilsons were not. But this was just a way of social life and a way of economic life. It's the way that part of the country had functioned for several hundred years. That being the case, as I try to point out in the book, if you look at some of Woodrow Wilson's statements, especially ones that I found a few that hadn't been published before, no matter what their context, they are just purely racist. This is a man who really did judge people by the color of their skin upon first meeting. And as a result of that, when Wilson came into office, he did introduce segregation into Washington, D.C., into two departments, the post office and the Treasury Department. And as a result of that, that basically sanctioned segregation anywhere that any state deemed it necessary. So
there were a number of firsts in his life and career. And before we get into World War I, I want to talk a little bit about that, because he really, perhaps more than any other president, had so many firsts. Let's talk about some of those, particularly while he was in office, some of the legislation that really continues to affect us today.
No question about it. And I think we have to start with the fact that he was the first president who appeared in Congress in over 100 years. You know, we now have this great annual tradition where the President of the United States comes to the Congress, gives the State of the Union address. No president had done anything like that since John Adams. There was a real separation of powers, a separation of these branches. And Wilson thought this was a huge mistake. He thought the two branches should be talking to each other and that there should be a face on each branch, at least on that of the White House. So Wilson was barely in office when he had his first piece of legislation that he wanted to pass, and he called a joint session of Congress. And it was, you know, still dead of summer, but it made the point that this was so important, Congress had to convene. And he went and presented what was a tariff bill, in fact, saying how we had to lower tariffs and basically we would be having a higher income tax instead. And this was extremely important to Wilson to do this, and it was extremely important for the legislature. And it passed, because the other thing Wilson did is he came back time and again and sat in a little room off the Senate floor called the President's Room. And there he would just greet senators, twist their elbows, hold out patronage, whatever it took to get them to pass his bills.
We are talking about the new book, Wilson, the biography written by A. Scott Berg, who is our guest today. It is a fascinating look at a very complex individual. We'll be back with more on Wilson and your questions as well when Radio Times comes right back.
Lehigh University supports WHYY and presents Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. Hersh will provide a Washington reporter's perspective on American foreign policy during the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The 2013 Tresolini Lecture in Law on Thursday, October 3rd at 8 p.m., Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University, open to the public. No tickets are required. Details on the Lehigh website and at 610-758-3340.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the new president of Iran comes to New York for the UN General Assembly. His supporters say he needs to change the world's view of his country.
I think many of people of the board think Iranian people are something like terrorist guys, but as you know, they are not. The people of Iran are good persons.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The symphony must embrace the world, said Gustav Mahler. And in his fourth symphony, Mahler's world is viewed through the eyes of a child. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Mahler's Symphony No. 4. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. October 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Kimmel Center, Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts Mahler's Fourth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about President Woodrow Wilson. It's 100 years since he was inaugurated the 28th President of the United States, and in this 100th year anniversary, there is a new biography simply titled Wilson. The author is A. Scott Berg. He is our guest in studio today. We'd love your comments and your questions about President Wilson's life. The number is 888-477-9499. Scott, when we left off, we were talking about all the firsts inaugurated by Woodrow Wilson in his years as president. And you were talking about him addressing a joint session of Congress, for instance, that no one had done that since President Adams.
Exactly right. And there were a number of firsts. In fact, the first couple of years, everything Wilson did was a first. There were two real themes in his presidency. One was he believed in transparency, and the other was leveling the playing field for Americans. This was extremely important to him. And so Wilson held the first press conferences, for example, as many as 60 the first year. I mean, the press was in and out of the White House for the first time. He started the Federal Reserve System because this was a way he thought it could take some of the power away from the Eastern bankers. Wilson introduced the 8-hour workday, workman's compensation. Wilson put the first Jew on the Supreme Court and brought a number of other Jews into high-level positions during the war and thereafter. And then Wilson did bring us into war, so suddenly we have the Selective Service. This was a first. We also had Wilson give a speech in 1917 on April 2nd when he asked a joint session of Congress to declare war on Germany. And there is a sentence within that speech which really is a major first because it is the foundation of American foreign policy to this day. And that sentence was quite simply, "The world must be made safe for democracy." And when you look at what is happening anywhere in American foreign policy today, whether it is Syria or over the years Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam, it was almost always in the name of Wilson, making the world safe for democracy. For good or bad, whether you like him or not, that's the way it was, and that's the world we live in. Woodrow Wilson.
It's hard to escape the parallels, even as we look at President Obama and what he's looking at in terms of foreign policy today.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, here's another man people say is a cool, aloof intellectual, a constitutional scholar, rather like Wilson, with some big differences, I think, at least the ones that are visible to me. I mean, I have studied Woodrow Wilson now for 13 years putting this book together, and I did see a much more passionate man than at least I see in Barack Obama. Maybe in the privacy of his White House, he's something quite other. And in fact, there he is a father with daughters, as Woodrow Wilson had three daughters, and apparently a very loving spouse. So perhaps there are more parallels than we know. But Wilson was willing to put his emotions on the table, to wear them on his sleeve.
Yeah. There are so many things that we want to talk about that were happening as we entered World War I. Obviously, we eventually did get involved in that war. And there were a host of other events that were just unfolding rapid fire in this country. Give us a sense of what's going on politically now, as well as personally for Woodrow Wilson during the first 4 years and as we get into World War I then.
Well, On a personal level for Wilson, of course, he was getting over the tragedy of his wife's death. And this really can't be underestimated. And it's something I've really tried to do with this book. I did want to write a page-turner of a presidential biography. I wanted people to read this book as though it were a novel, because it is a great story as it unfolded to me, and I hope so for readers as well. And so what was going on was Wilson was gradually, as he realized the Germans were not relenting in their policy, he was gradually bringing us into the war. I think Wilson realized there was some inevitability that we were going to be getting into this. Now, while this is going on, race relations are really brewing, I should say starting to boil over, something Wilson really didn't want to deal with for a long time. He just didn't think the country was ready to integrate, and he felt segregation was the easiest way to deal with that particular problem. Now, you also have women clamoring for the vote, really. They're almost at the top of the hill there where they think they can finally get it. Wilson was a little slow in the beginning. He thought it should be state by state as opposed to a federal amendment. But once we got into the war, Wilson realized two things, that we were fighting for democracy around the world. How can we be denying half our population the right to take part in democracy? And second, he realized the vital role women were playing in America during the war, keeping the home fires burning. And as a result, he became this very activist president in terms of getting women the vote, which they did shortly after the war.
Certainly, one of his big priorities was the creation of a League of Nations. Tell us about that and his struggles around trying to get that off the ground and getting Americans to embrace it.
Well, this is probably the most dramatic story in Woodrow Wilson's life and maybe in any of our presidents' lives, because it's one of those few instances in which a president all but literally put his life on the line for a cause. This was not for any personal riches or self-aggrandizement. This was just to promote a cause that he thought was for the betterment of mankind. And it was quite simply this. The main reason he brought us into the war, I believe, was so that he could have a role in dictating the peace. And he had 14 points for this peace, and the 14th was the creation of a League of Nations, a kind of parliament where every nation could come sit at a table, almost like sitting at King Arthur's Round Table. Everybody could speak. And basically, they would discuss any skirmish in the world before it blew up into a war. And if for some reason somebody violated the rules of the world, of the League countries were prepared to send an army, collective security, if you will, to fight that outlying nation.
Well, and it sounds like in another sort of modern day comparison, there was a lot of partisan politics going on around the idea of getting that League of Nations established, at least here in the United States.
How to tell you, partisan politics ain't new. And in fact, I don't want to be glib, but I'm not really aware of partisan politics ever being quite as hostile as they were in Woodrow Wilson's day. It was personal. And some of the Republicans, especially the Republican leader, actively hated Woodrow Wilson. No question about it. Henry Cabot Lodge led the Republican Party then. And Wilson, realizing the Senate was not going to ratify his peace treaty that he brought back from Paris, which included his League of Nations, decided he would circumvent the Senate and go to the people directly. And he embarked on just this quixotic journey. It was a 29-city train tour in the middle of the summer of 1919. In steel, un-air-conditioned cars. He was in very fragile health, worse health than he knew because he had advanced arteriosclerosis, which even his doctor didn't let on to his patient how bad he was. And Wilson, halfway through this tour, giving these sometimes four or five speeches a day, just collapsed, and they rushed him home to Washington, and there, days later, he suffered a stroke.
Well, and that brings up a couple of things, because he had health challenges for many years prior, correct? That was always a concern for him.
No question about it. He was in fragile physical health all his life. Now, with the benefit of 100 years and my being able to go through his medical records, which I was able to do, some personal papers from his doctor, we can now trace the fact that he was probably having minor strokes for decades before he entered the White House. Certainly, if he were a candidate for president today, anybody would question his ability to serve. As a result of what did happen in the Wilson administration when he did have his stroke, we now have a 25th Amendment to the Constitution, which clearly defines presidential disability, because what happened in the Wilson administration, as I suggest in the book, was the greatest conspiracy that ever overtook the White House.
Well, his wife ended up running the country for a long period of time.
You have just hit it. His wife and a handful of physicians kept the stroke that the president had suffered from the world for a year and a half. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And basically, the second Mrs. Wilson, this widow he had married upon the death of his first wife, who was not educated in politics or really much else other than fashion and jewelry, she was basically, for all intents and purposes, running the day-to-day operations of the United States of America.
How was that possible, Scott? It's just, to us in this day and age, it's unimaginable. But even then, to hide something like that for a year and a half?
Well, for one, Mrs. Wilson did not tweet or Instagram. So there was that that made it a little easier to pass it off. But seriously, you know, it was at quite a different age. The White House back in those days had maybe a dozen people who worked in the Oval Office, in and around that. And when I say a dozen, it wasn't even that many. It was just a smaller operation. It was a smaller country. It was, in some ways, a smaller time. But it was that moment that the United States was starting to explode and starting to become this major superpower. But in that one little window, they were able to keep the President of the United States locked up in his bedroom. He did not lose his power to speak or to reason, so he could still think. He was half paralyzed, but again, 100 years later, we know much more about mental health and strokes today than they did then, and we can see there were great emotional things going on with him, a great, you know, oscillation in his thoughts, his feelings. And it gets a little scary when you think this was the President of the United States.
Were there not some perhaps bouts of dementia as well?
I believe there were, and I have a couple of episodes in the book of when Wilson was over in Paris for the 6 months negotiating the treaty. And let me just repeat that. The president was gone for 6 months, for half a year. The president of the United States was in France. I mean, this was crazy. So there's another first for you. And he was, in fact, the first president to leave the country and go on un-American, non-American soil. And Wilson, during that period, there are a couple of episodes of truly aberrant behavior. And there's one moment I found kind of chilling, which was just, I mean, these, you know, there are a handful of men carving up the world. And there's Woodrow Wilson walking in to a meeting one day and says, I don't like the way the furniture's arranged here. I don't like the purple next to the green. And I want all the red chairs over here and all the blue chairs here. And the doctor's sort of looking at him and saying, Mr. President, maybe we should take a walk. And that's fine. And then it all blows over. And then an hour later, Woodrow Wilson is not rearranging furniture. He is rearranging the map of the world.
Yeah. Wow. How did Mrs. Wilson do running the country for those 18 months or so?
Well, we're still here. Mrs. Wilson would say she did nothing her husband wouldn't have done. She insisted she was just a steward, that she made no decisions on her own. To some extent, that's true. But nobody saw the President of the United States, or no document passed before his eyes that she had not seen first. So in essence, she decided everything the President would be able to decide upon. She would present the arguments to him, she would hear what he had to say, and then she would present that back to whoever had come to petition the President. So she was something of a chief of staff, a little more than a gatekeeper, I would say. You know, she was in that the government kept working, in that it kept rolling. She was acting in a presidential manner.
It's just so remarkable that she was able to do this for that amount of time, that the word did not get out sooner. But as you said, there was an amendment added as a result of that situation.
Absolutely right. It's a stunning story, though. Yeah. And there's nothing like it in American history.
Yeah. So when Wilson leaves office, Harding is elected, and that's seen as a repudiation of much of what Wilson stood for. Talk about that.
It was a repudiation of almost everything Wilson stood for, starting with, you know, Harding's motto was return to normalcy, which was basically to say, come home, America. We've had our international experience. Let's return to isolationism. Everything was fine. The family was all together. Everybody was at home. Let's get rid of these lower tariffs that Wilson brought in. Let's, you know, business is good for America. Let's make the rich a little richer because everything will work a little better. All that was a real slap in the face to Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
Total slap.
And then Harding dies in office.
Harding dies in office, ironically. And even before he died, the corruption of Harding personally and his administration was coming forward. And people began to long for Woodrow Wilson, squeaky clean, highly moral, not even a breath of a scandal during his 8 years in office. And Wilson was looking very good. Maybe idealism isn't such a bad thing for Americans to have. You know, as Wilson used to say, yes, I'm an idealist. That's how I know I'm an American.
Isn't there a scene where Wilson is riding with President-elect Harding to the inauguration, and Wilson is unable to get out of the car, and there's some emotions there? Tell us that story.
Yes, this is for Harding's inauguration in 1921. Wilson, as I said, was half paralyzed. They ride down Pennsylvania Avenue together. The first time a car was used to convey the President-elect to the Capitol. It had always been a horse and carriage. And when they finally get to the Capitol, Wilson really can't even get out of the car, of course. And Harding just gets out on his own and bounds up the steps to the Capitol where he's going to go and take the oath of office, leaving Wilson alone to be taken around to a freight elevator where somebody's going to meet him with a wheelchair and carry him up there. And it just infuriated Mrs. Wilson, especially in the car behind them, that Harding would just neglect this man who had served the country for 8 years and really all but given his life and just leave him there. But, you know, as Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, Alice Longworth, said to me once, I got to know her a little when I was in my 20s, and we were talking about Harding one day, and she said, you know, Harding wasn't really a bad man. He was just a slob.
Well, that's a different way to look at it, right? And, you know, when you think about Wilson, certainly there is, again, a contradiction. When you think about someone who came into the White House with so much promise, so many ideas, so much enthusiasm, so many dreams, and yet ended up, by many accounts, a tragic figure.
No question about it. What did I say at the beginning? I was drawn to tragic idealists, yeah. And there he was. He definitely was a tragic figure in the end. And yet something very interesting happened when Harding was in office, and there's Wilson, the only president, the first, to retire to Washington, D.C. He left the White House and moved into a beautiful house in Northwest Washington.
We will talk much more about this new biography, Wilson, by A. Scott Berg. And by the way, Scott is going to be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. So if we have piqued your interest in the life of Woodrow Wilson, you'll definitely want to make sure that you get to the library tonight at 7:30 to hear a little bit more. Radio Times will be back right after this.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 2nd in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization that was not apparently on the ropes.
This particular attack is really a failure on the part of the international community, including the United States.
How a ragtag Somali guerrilla organization took on the world in a Nairobi shopping mall. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners to discover how a master's degree in pastoral counseling can help prepare adults for roles in community and mental health counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. There's an information session on October 1st at Newman's campus in Delaware County. Details online at neumann.edu. Newman University supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the life of President Woodrow Wilson, America's 28th president. This year marks the 100th anniversary of his inauguration, and it marks the release of a new biography by A. Scott Berg. It is simply entitled Wilson, and it is a fascinating chronicle of the life of America's 28th president. We welcome your calls to our conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. Scott, when we left off, we were talking about Wilson being a contradiction, even in the sense that he was a very promising figure, highly intellectual, a lot of enthusiasm and dreams, and yet was a tragic idealist, as you mentioned. One thing I wanted to talk about that we didn't get around to was that he spent some time in the Philadelphia area in his career prior to becoming president.
Very much. When Wilson realized early on that he probably could not have a political career because he felt he didn't have enough money or enough family power or prestige, and he had fallen in love with his first wife and they immediately had three daughters, he realized he needed to make a living, and he chose academia, which he loved and he was very good at. And so his first job, while in fact he was completing his PhD, our only president with a PhD, at Johns Hopkins, he received an offer to teach at a new women's college called Bryn Mawr College. And Wilson was part of the cohort of the first professors when they opened the doors at Bryn Mawr. And Wilson was there and, you know, had a dozen students that he taught in history and politics, government, a little economics thrown in. And it was a wonderful opportunity for him because it started him on his teaching career. That being said, he wasn't very happy. He was a little disturbed about teaching women, which was something of a novelty at that time. This is, you know, in the 1880s. And Mrs. Wilson was not happy about it at all, I should add. And I'll presume it's because she felt the women were not worthy of her husband. So he was here for a while and always liked Philadelphia, but did not especially like teaching at Bryn Mawr, and got out of his contract as quickly as he could, in fact, and moved on to Wesleyan and then finally to teach at Princeton.
Well, he may not have enjoyed teaching women so much, but as you pointed out earlier, he certainly loved and appreciated women. And in fact, there was someone prior to his first wife that he had great affection for. And obviously that didn't work out. Tell us that story.
Well, it didn't work out. It's an interesting story, but Woodrow Wilson fell in love with his first cousin and desperately wanted to marry her. I've got a picture of her in the book, and, well, I don't want to be superficial, but, well, she was not what we call an oil painting. And you sort of wonder. But it made you think that Woodrow Wilson was so desperate to be in love. I mean, he truly was a diehard romantic. And you see this in these love letters that I went through, the hundreds he wrote to his second wife, the thousands of love letters he wrote to his first wife while they were courting, and indeed the letters he wrote to his cousin Hattie, who finally said, Cousin Woodrow, I don't love you that way, and I'm not sure this is right. And he said, no, I've already checked it with our parents. It's okay with them. And she said, yes, but I don't really feel that way about you.
So, can't we just be friends? And she did oblige him.
Can't
in
just this. Be cousins.
Well, and she did. Right, exactly. She did oblige him when he requested a picture.
Well, yes. I mean, oh, boy. Yes, when they finally broke up, he said, fine, but here's what I'd like. I want you to go to this photographer. I want you to do your hair a certain way. I want you to wear this specific dress. I want you to have two photographs, or two prints, one photograph made, but two prints, one for you and one for me. And I will pay for it, but you must do that. And indeed, she did oblige him, and she sent the picture, which is the picture I just referred to. And basically, that was the end of the romance, if you will. Yeah. And she got married shortly thereafter to somebody she wasn't related to.
We have a few people who would like to talk with you as we talk about President Woodrow Wilson. We'll start off in Allentown, Pennsylvania, with Larry. Welcome, Larry, to Radio Times.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking the call. I wonder if you could comment on the international regard for Wilson. You know, my understanding of history is it's kind of mixed. Some people think he was a great hero, and others think he was basically taken advantage of by the Brits and the French after the war, and that he was kind of played the fool. But you know, I'd love to get your take on that.
You raise very good questions on all counts. When Woodrow Wilson arrived in Paris, and it is the opening scene of my book, really, as you see this arrival, it was the greatest arrival of any human being in any city. It was the greatest march of triumph the world had ever seen, and I'm not forgetting Caesar or Napoleon or Alexander the Great. Just in sheer numbers, 2 million people turned out in Paris, which had a population of 1 million. I mean, it was extraordinary. And wherever he went, he then visited London and Rome, and he was hailed everywhere. Just all the hopes of the world were placed on his shoulders. Even the Germans were hoping for clemency from Woodrow Wilson. So that is the setup. Now, to answer your question, whether he was duped by the French, by the British, he wasn't really. Wilson knew what was going on. He knew what he was up against. But here's the problem he faced. Wilson arrived in Paris to negotiate this treaty, and there were 24 other nations there. Each one of those nations had its own agenda to win back territory or to win back some money, some compensation for the war. Wilson was the only one there, you see, who didn't have that agenda. He didn't want to build an empire. He didn't want money out of anybody. What he wanted was his cause, his ideal. He wanted to advance a League of Nations. That was pretty much it. And so, toward the end, as he's now, and again to remind you, away from the country for 6 months, Wilson began at the end, and who knows what was going on with him mentally as well. He was making little compromises and one or two big compromises, largely just to get home and to get home with a treaty that contained the League of Nations. So he did put all his eggs in that one basket. I truly don't think he was duped in any way. I just think he felt he had to make these compromises in order to get home with his league.
Scott, as I look at this book, it is a 700-plus page book, not counting notes and so forth, meticulously researched. How long did it take you to pull all of this information together and put it in a book form?
The book took 13 years altogether. 8 of those years were spent doing research. And it's hard to believe, but even here 100 years after Wilson was president, new papers surfaced. 2 major caches of papers were found in attics, one belonging to one of Wilson's daughters and one belonging to Wilson's physician and personal friend, Dr. Cary Grayson. So those really enabled me to do what I try to do in my biographies, which is really to flesh out the subject, to humanize him, to personalize him. So that was the first 8 years, going through papers, archives, diaries, memorandums, things like that. Then I spent about a half year sifting through all the note cards, all the Xeroxes, every scrap of paper I had. And then I spent about 4.5 years doing the actual writing and rewriting of the book.
You tell your students or you encourage them to look at these characters that they may write about and decide, you know, what light did they shed? What do you think about Wilson, having done all this research? And you also had said earlier that you couldn't really reach a verdict about him until you got comfortable and really started writing the book. So having written it, what's the verdict on Wilson?
That is true, and I did say all that. I did teach a class in biography at Princeton 1 year, and my verdict on Wilson is a mixed bag, but largely a positive view of him. No matter whether anyone agrees with his policies, no matter whether anyone likes him personally, I think one cannot deny the greatness of the man. There is just too much in our modern life, our lives today, that trace directly back to something Woodrow Wilson said, thought, or did, that he is just an undeniable force. And perhaps at the end of the day, the reason I wrote this book was that I felt he was becoming a forgotten figure, and I felt people should know about him. Again, you can love him or hate him, but you should at least know him. And I hope even more than that, that you might be able to feel him in reading my book.
What was the most surprising thing that you came across as you did all this research?
Well, there were a couple of little surprises. Again, you know, here we are 100 years later. So I did find an assassination attempt on Wilson's life that nobody knew about. I found a secret operation, a minor physical operation that he underwent, which became a kind of dress rehearsal for the stroke that they never told about, because this little operation nobody knew about either. But I think the major thing is about his character. And I think it is that I had no idea how deeply passionate Woodrow Wilson was about the women in his life, his two wives, his three daughters. Most of his friends were women. He was very comfortable. He loved playing to women. Or how deeply he felt things, that this is the man, you know, most biographies, every biography of Wilson tells you about that famous speech he gave, "The world must be made safe for democracy." Few tell you what happened the moment later when he and his wife got in the car, drove back to the White House in silence. Wilson goes to his office, puts his head down on the table, and sobs because he realized he had just basically written the death warrants for 100,000 American soldiers. So this is a president who really felt deeply.
What modern-day figure might you compare him to? I know we talked about President Obama briefly. Is there someone else who comes to mind that you can compare Woodrow Wilson to?
I'm a little hard-pressed. I mean, Obama certainly lingers because I do think he is a man of high thoughts. I do think he's a man who sees a big picture. So I think he probably comes closest. But it's hard for me, especially as the times have become so political and partisan again, to think of another figure, a public figure, who so strongly attached himself with a cause. I mean, Martin Luther King certainly was such a figure. I mean, there is one, a man who lived for a cause. So I would say Woodrow Wilson's cause, while it was hardly Martin Luther King's, was felt as fervently and fought for as hard as Martin Luther King's was.
The reader will quickly take note upon opening your book that the chapter titles are often the titles of books of the Bible or other biblical terms. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Yes, they are. And I have a little quotation, an epigraph that starts off each chapter, which was taken from the Bible. And I did this because Woodrow Wilson was a Presbyterian minister's son and grandson, and if you shake the family tree of the Woodrows and the Wilsons, I think another dozen ministers will fall from the branches. And as a result of that, this was a man who got on his knees twice a day to pray. He said grace before every meal. He read the Bible every night. I thought this should infuse the book. I wanted the reader to be aware how spiritual this man was. And I thought that the selections I chose and the chapter titles would reflect what I felt Wilson would have been feeling as he was going through his life. And I should remind your audience that Sigmund Freud wrote actually a whole book on Woodrow Wilson, just psychoanalyzing him from afar. And the essence of the book was that Woodrow Wilson had a huge Christ complex.
Well, will we be seeing Woodrow Wilson on the big screen?
Well, it appears that we may very well. Just this week, two really wonderful things happened to this book. The first is it just hit the national bestseller list on the New York Times. And the second is that Leonardo DiCaprio and his production company and Warner Brothers have just taken the material. They've optioned it, and we're now looking for, they're bringing me along too as one of the producers, and we're now looking for a screenwriter. We've already had discussions on what the movie might be, probably will be about, which part of Woodrow Wilson's life, and we're now searching. So I think so. So all those people who for years have been saying how unsexy Woodrow Wilson is, I say two words, Leonardo DiCaprio.
There you have it. Who else might you like to see in that movie?
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, should Brad Pitt play the vice president?
Well, what's the time frame for the movie? I mean, how soon might we actually start seeing this in theaters?
Well, I don't think we have to buy our tuxedos for the premiere. But we are now actively looking for the screenwriter. And then, you know, you never know whether the screenwriter will hit it the first time or if it'll take a year or two or how many ever years it takes to put it together. But I would say in a perfect world, perhaps in a couple of years, you know, we could have it filmed and out there. But these things take an awfully long time, movies.
What are your thoughts about being involved in that process as the author who has spent 13 years researching and putting together this book, knowing that the movie may not be exactly like the book?
Well, I feel fine about it. I hasten to add that I grew up in a show business family, so I have watched the movie process all my life. I know how it works and more often how it doesn't work. And in fact, my first book, a biography of Max Perkins, a book editor, has been in the works for about 35 years. And it does seem as though they're finally about to film that early next year with Colin Firth playing Max Perkins. But again, I don't dress for the premiere until the movie is all done.
And Lindbergh is optioned.
And Lindbergh,
well,
yes, Steven Spielberg bought Lindbergh a decade ago.
Yeah. We are talking with multi-award-winning author A. Scott Berg. He has just written a biography simply entitled Wilson. It is the story of America's 28th president. And if you'd like to hear more, you have an opportunity to hear Scott Berg speak tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. That will be at 7:30. So if you'd like to hear more, that is your opportunity. Scott Berg, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Tracy. It's really been fun.
And many thanks to our senior engineer, Fred Snyder. We also want to thank our producers, Emily Bryant, Debbie Bilder, Susan Greenbaum, and Patty McMahon. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.